Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Kevin Anatuzio, registration 13119. Along with my partner, David Fawley, we represent the appellant, American Family Mutual Insurance Company. We have a watershed or threshold issue in this case on appeal, and that's the simple question whether or not there was coverage for the Hanf judgment against Sundog in the first liability case.
In that regard, counsel, are you asking us to reconsider the line that was drawn in Colorado Pool Systems concerning rip and tear damages, or are you accepting that as controlling precedent and arguing its application to your case?
I know it's my recollection cert was granted on Colorado Pools, both on that issue and on the common law application to tear out damages.
But I believe that's not correct.
I think the
cert grant was only on the retroactivity of the statute.
I stand correct. We think that's an erroneous ruling. Okay. Rip and tear out costs are covered. However, I point out that the underlying record doesn't reflect a factual basis for finding that there were rip and tear out costs.
Okay.
The evidence essentially confirms, I think beyond any doubt, that this was a punch list case. It was faulty, defective, incomplete work that didn't comply with the contract documents. We can look at the statutory notice, the defect list from the Hanf lawsuit, the Higgins and Klein reports. They're all laundry lists of missing work, incomplete work, work that didn't meet the owner's expectations, but it wasn't damaged property. Mr. Higgins' own trial testimony, the expert called by Sundog, he said this was not a resulting damage case. It was a punch list case. He categorized the damages into three different groups: construction defects, things that weren't in compliance with code or plans, punch list items, things that weren't done to the owner's satisfaction or not completed, and warranty items, things that were installed that don't work correctly. And if you have plowed through the record, you will see marble countertops replaced because the grain didn't match on adjoining pieces, holes that were drilled in sinks for faucets that didn't center over the cabinet with the mirror in it, and were rejected because they didn't meet the owner's requirements, but those weren't damaged. They were simply items that didn't pass to the satisfaction of the owner. All of the CD, the punch list, and the warranty items simply don't have coverage under a CGL, and that's a function of two things. As a predicate matter, it is a function of the definition of an occurrence in the policy, which is an accident. And in a host of cases from this court as well as the Tenth Circuit, it has repeatedly been reaffirmed that faulty work is not covered under a CGL policy. And the MFAM policy is a standard ISO commercial general liability form. McGowan and Hottenstein, Adair Group out of the Tenth Circuit, general security case, and TCD more recently from this court. And this is not a statute case. The Construction Defect Reform Act doesn't apply here. So we're talking about the common law of Colorado, which most recently, prior to this case, was the general security decision from this court. Gaffigan argues there were some covered items of damage, which would have to, by definition, be resulting damage to non-defective work. That does not equate to a finding of coverage. We disagree that the record would show that there were any such items, but the definition of occurrence is only the first step in the insurance coverage analysis. That's where the question whether it was accidental or not comes into play. And faulty work is not viewed in Colorado as the result of an accident. The decision how to build something is intentional, even if you build it wrong, or if you don't complete the work, or if you leave something off. That's not an accident. But even if there was resulting damage, we only go to the next step in the equation, which is if the occurrence element is satisfied, are there any exclusions in the policy that would negate coverage that might otherwise arise under the insuring agreement? We have a CGL policy, which the case law repeatedly has affirmed was not designed or intended, and its language does not extend coverage for what are called the business risks. There are a group of business risk exclusions in the policy, J5, J6, L&M, which generally stand for the proposition faulty work is not covered. The remedy for defective, incomplete work, or even work that's damaged during construction, is the contractor is to fix it. The remedy is a performance bond, not commercial general liability insurance. This is reflected particularly in J5 and J6. But before we get to those, I want to talk about J1. That's the first of the exclusions for property damage. It's the owned property exclusion. This court dealt with it in Cedar Lane, which I'll talk about in a minute. But it quite unambiguously, as Cedar Lane reflects, holds that any damage to property that's owned, leased, or occupied by the insured is not covered. And that's true regardless whether it's faulty work, whether it's resulting damage to property that's not itself defective. The kind or character of the property damage doesn't matter. If it's owned by the insured at the time the property damage occurs, it is flat not covered. The evidence is undisputed in this case that the 107 or 110 items on the defect list Mr. Hamp complained of were presented to Sundog at the time of closing. Actually, it was the second closing day. But it was at that time that they agreed that the sale would go forward, and Mr. Hamp took possession and moved into the home, even though those 100-odd items were defective or incomplete. With a broad brush, we can swipe coverage or potential coverage for all of those items out of this case, because Cedar Lane holds that that exclusion is unambiguous. And it's not the time when the damage was discovered. Sundog made a lot in the trial court about the fact that the defect list grew after Mr. Hamp had taken title and moved into the property. But that's not the question. The question is not when it was discovered, it's when the property damage occurred.
What about damage to non-defective work that occurred during the repair process after Mr. Hamp took possession?
I would first point to the record. There's absolutely no evidence as to any specific item of work that was done after closing, after Hamp took possession of the home. There's no evidence of what that work was, and there's additionally no evidence of any damage that occurred during that period. Simply a failure proof on that point in the trial record. Now, even if that were not the case, there are still exclusions in the policy that apply. I'd like you to envision a timeline. The question about whether there's an occurrence, that issue, if there's no occurrence, precludes coverage for the entire life of the property damage. The same with the impaired property exclusion applies for the entire length of the property damage. The same with the J5 exclusion, performing operations. There's no exception in J5 for damage that might occur during the completed operations period, or to translate to this case, property damage that occurred after Mr. Hamp took possession of the home. There's simply no exclusion for that. If the damage arose while Sundog, which is defined in the policy to include any subcontractors or anyone else working on Sundog's behalf, if they're in there after closing and they cause damage, J5 excludes it because they're still performing operations and there's no completed operations exception to J5. Only two exclusions lose their effect once you're in the completed operations period. That's J1, which is the owned property exclusion by definition, and J6, which is your work. But again, given that the record fails to show any specific work that was done after closing and Hamp took possession of the property, and specifically doesn't show any damage that occurred during that period, there's simply been a failure of proof on that question.
Didn't Mr. Gaffigan testify that there was ongoing work by various subs after closing, and that he believed some of the work by the subs damaged non-defective work after closing?
The specific reference I recall in the transcript and from the trial testimony was Mr. Polk asked him about examples, and he provided some general examples of things that can happen when trades are working, that they may walk through the tool belt and graze trim, that they may damage drywall beyond the hole where they're doing electrical work to install a light fixture. But he was talking in generalities, and nobody ever said, here's an item of damage in this part of the house. This was caused by a subcontractor other than the sub who did this work, and this is when it happened. It was, if you will, littering generalities. And I would note that two instances that are cited in the record for testimony were objected to by Mr. Foley or by me in trial court, and the objection was sustained for lack of personal knowledge. Mr. Higgins, the expert, couldn't testify about what damage happened when or which trade may have caused it. And similarly, Mr. Gaffigan was not there when these damages were caused. I think it's important to consider the coverage issue, the absence of coverage, in relation to the supplementary payments issue. The policy says we'll pay with respect to suits we defend certain supplementary payments, and that includes interest on the judgment, costs taxed against the insured, but it's important that suit is a defined term. Suit is defined as an action against the insured that's seeking damages covered by the policy. You cannot read that provision without taking into account the fundamental substantive law in Colorado that Heckler Mining and Cotter and his progeny have taught us, which is in Colorado, an insurance company faced with a doubtful coverage situation properly defends under a reservation of rights, and it reserves the right to recoup its defense expenses back from the insured at the end of the day if there's no coverage. That's not in the insurance policy, but it is a settled substantive principle of Colorado law. I think the Cotter Corp case makes it very clear what the quid pro quo was. Colorado Supreme Court has imposed an extremely broad duty to defend upon a liability insurer. The quid pro quo is to encourage the defense of doubtful coverage cases so that the insured gets the benefit of the doubt. The carrier in return is entitled to reserve its rights to get its defense expenses back if there's no coverage at the end of the day. That principle is completely at odds with the position that Gaffigan and Associates takes in this case, that irrespective of the coverage situation, supplementary payments are due. I think that the Golden Eagle case that we cited from the appellate court in California is highly instructive and very helpful on this issue. Why is the California case important? Because California, like Colorado, recognizes as a matter of its substantive common law that an insurance company can properly defend a doubtful coverage case under reservation of rights and get their defense costs back at the end of the day. Now, with the overlay of that principle, what the Golden Eagle case said is, if you defend under reservation and there's ultimately no coverage, you never had a duty to defend in the first instance. Ergo, the supplementary payments provision is never triggered, and the duty to pay those supplementary payments never arises because you defended under reservation and you ultimately never had a duty to defend in the first instance. That's the principle that's entirely consistent with the body of law we have here in Colorado, where we have to apply the same considerations. It was kind of funny to read the Golden Eagle case. They cite the corollary proposition that no good deed goes unpunished. And you don't want to punish insurance companies who properly accept the defense of a doubtful coverage case. They end up having a determination there's no coverage, they don't have to pay the judgment. But the incongruity is they end up paying interest on the judgment, paying costs that were taxed against the insured as an adjunct to an award of damages not covered under the policy. It simply makes no sense. And it's fundamentally at odds with what Heckler and Cotter teach us, that if you defend under reservation, there's no coverage at the end of the day, the carrier can get its defense expenses back. This Court of Appeals touched on this proposition in Borer versus Church Mutual, the Borer II case, And I'll cite it because there's two. It's 12 P3rd 854, decided in 2000. That case involved a commingling of uncovered conduct and covered conduct. It was one of those church counseling cases where the negligent counseling degenerated into sexual misconduct with a parishioner. 70% was ascribed to the sexual misconduct, which was excluded from coverage. 30% was ascribed to negligence, which was covered under the policy. And I may have those percentages flipped, but it doesn't change the outcome. The plaintiff and the insurer both argued, well, you owe 100% of the interest under the supplementary payments clause, because it says you'll pay all the interest on any judgment in an action we defend. And this court rejected that and said, we're not going to punish insurance companies by making them pay interest on damages that are not covered by the insurance policy. And this court prorated the interest corresponding to the percentages of covered and uncovered damages that the court had found in the underlying liability case. But what does that tell us?
Well, I think what it tells us is, counsel, your time is exhausted. So if you could wrap up in a sentence or two, please.
There are other issues. The apportionment question. It's our belief that the law requires the Hanf verdict to be apportioned. Since it couldn't be done, judgment should have entered for us. If the case is not remanded for dismissal, we think that the evidentiary issues and jury instructions mandate at a minimum a new trial. But I thank the court.
Run the lectern down if you wish.
Yeah, I recognize I'm short. I'll just move the mic.
Well, maybe it's tall.
Well, maybe, but I may it please the court. I am Dennis Polk. My attorney registration number is 8777. Also with me on this matter is Ms. Heather Hodgson. I'd like to address the matters that Mr. Amatuzio brought forth to you in sort of inverse order. The fundamental organic document and structure we have to examine is actually the CGL policy. The beginning place and ending place for analysis is there. On the cost issue, had the carrier intended the result that Mr. Amatuzio suggests they could have so stated, the language that is before you is clear. It's Exhibit 1 in the trial court. It wasn't contested. And the cost issue, simple. It says, in any suit in which we investigate, settle, or defend, we will pay those costs that are assessed against you. And that's what it says. It doesn't say if we have otherwise stated in our policy or anything else. And in fact, if you look at the actual policy that is there, and we look at the coverage grant, which is the basis for all claims, because we start in looking at a policy at the coverage grant, and it is a broad grant of coverage. But interestingly enough, this carrier specifically said, however, we will have no duty to defend the insured against any suit seeking damages for bodily injury or property damage in which this insurance does not apply. So they had to have understood the distinction, and they could have provided, as subsequent ISO forms do, it changes the language that we are dealing with. It is that issue with regard to the cost that's important, because the carrier in this instance was obligated to pay the costs that were assessed. That becomes the linchpin of a series of eventualities that lead us to a variety of bad faith determinations in this case. And that becomes critically important, because had the carrier even gone so far as to do what it was contractually obligated to do and it tendered those costs, then we would be having an entirely different discussion. The other issues, frankly, that are raised by counsel are largely matters that are within the sound discretion of the trial court, or for which the factual basis was disputed in the trial court. The record before the trial court in this action also included the underlying Hanf action. I recollect that there was a full transcript of that proceeding. The witnesses testified in this case, and My recollection of the record is that there was evidence of damage that was, in fact, even within the Scottsdale test, would have been sufficient to allow the jury to reach their determinations. I recognize they may not like the modem or quantity or proof, but I think it's also important that don't forget, within the exhibits that were in the trial court, the coverage evaluation in the underlying lawsuit, the reports by retained insurance defense counsel uniformly say that there was resultant property damage. That fact was before the jury.
You mean damage, damage to non-defective work?
Damage to non-defective work. Because we, as we all know, a CGL policy does not use the word resultant damage, unlike a homeowner's policy where that term appears. The word resultant damage, in fact, doesn't occur in this. It says we will pay those damages that you become legally liable to pay because of bodily injury or property damage to which the insurance pays. Then if we start looking in the definitions, that it also sweeps in the notion of loss of use. That's the fact that gets overlooked.
Excuse me, was the expert reports referred to from the underlying trial, were those exhibits in the trial in this case?
I'm not sure the actual experts' reports were, in fact, exhibits. The experts testified, and I simply don't recall. I apologize.
Same experts.
But the same experts testified, and it's set forth in our briefs as to what they testified about, what they dealt with, and what their observations were.
Did any of them, if you know, did any of them specifically testify that after closing, repair efforts to defective work caused damage to non-defective work?
I don't recall whether the experts did that, but I think Mr. Gaffigan did say that, and I think there were instances in which one could derive a logical conclusion because it didn't exist as of a certain date, and it did exist afterwards, therefore creating the inference, at least, that it was after closing. But let's put that in context as well, Your Honor. This is a home that was not purely a spec, the home. There was a contract. The Hamps, and this is something, frankly, that isn't in the briefs because I don't think we all anticipated this issue fully, but the Hamps had a contractual right. They at least had an equitable interest in the property. So there would be damage to a third party to the extent that they had a contractual right to acquire this property. I think that that belies that argument. And in any event, there was a closing, and as we know, construction defect claims become progressive and continuous. And I don't think anybody is capable, as a practical matter, of saying that event happened at 12:01 on May 1st, and at some other event, 12:02 on June 1st. I don't think that the nature of construction defects is of that nature. For example, there are repeated references in this case about the damage done to the flooring system and how it was improperly adhered by a subcontractor. I believe that all of the experts said that that could and would result, including the professional engineer, in progressive and continuous damage. And I think that is adequately supported in the record. And the policy itself speaks to when something happens and when it is deemed to occur. I don't think that issue was argued by American Family in this case. And I think the actual facts belie what has happened, because I think there was progressive and continuous damage without being able to isolate it. It's not like the circumstance in Samuelson versus Chudik in which there was a hot water heater blew up. It is more akin, as counsel suggests, to Pinker. Which leads to the question that always happens in this is whether there's a years on the risk or an allocation issue and who bears the burden. I respectfully submit that in an insurance coverage case, when I'm representing a policyholder claimant, once I bring a claim within the ambit of coverage and show some element is covered, then the burden effectively shifts to the insurance carrier to show why it is not. And here, these same arguments, as the trial court determined, were both mixed questions of law and fact. The jury adversely determined these factual issues against American Family. And because it is a mixed question of law and fact, I think we need to give deference to the jury's determination of those disputed facts. And I think this case is basically that refined. These were either discretionary rulings of the trial court, or they were disputed issues of fact once we came within the general ambit of coverage. And so therefore, the plaintiff in the underlying case prevailed on those disputed issues of fact. We can all sit and look in a rearview mirror and perhaps second guess what those are. We don't have the ability to invade the province of the jury's mind, but the instructions, the arguments of counsel, and everything that happened in the underlying case all these years ago were before the jury, and those facts were adversely determined as to American Family. And so therefore, the plaintiff prevailed in this case. American Family didn't do what it was supposed to do, and the trial courts should be sustained as to that judgment. I think that I can sit and pound this thing forever, but it's just going to be a broken record. I've been here before. I'm happy to try to answer any questions that you may have. I think that, again, fundamentally, fact findings of a jury have something more valuable that we shouldn't be upsetting in this case. To recognize American Family doesn't like the outcome, but you know, they had other options at the time. If they were convinced of their positions in this case, they could have tendered the undisputed amount. They could have settled the underlying case. The factual evidence was rich at trial as to how little it would have taken to have settled the underlying case. That leads to a bad faith circumstance in this action. Their failures, their inability to follow their own policy, their lack of understanding of their own policy, especially the language contained within the supplementary payments, is demonstrative of why this jury verdict needs to be affirmed. Happy to answer any questions. I misquoted part of Mark Twain. Brevity can sometimes be the mark of a learned man. I don't claim to be learned, but I will try to be brief.
We always appreciate brevity.
Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.